There is chance they might get it, God forbid. If my father would only come with his men, it would be safe, declared Robin. He is the strongest knight in the king's bodyguard, and Elfred the Dane is his finest bowman. Elfred can shoot out the eyes of an owl at 200 paces. While he boasted, Robin's eyes shone. But, he ended sadly, neither Elfred nor my father is here. When supper was served in the great hall that evening, there were few gathered to eat it, because every man was on guard, and only the womenfolk and the children kept Sir Peter company. The two pages, Dennis and Lionel, attended them, and Robin, as usual, sat between Lady Constance and the two little boys. Dath and the other hounds seemed ill at ease. They paced up and down the hall, settled themselves in the rushes on the floor, only to rise and begin walking about again. "Down, Dath!" commanded Robin.
"Quiet, Roy! Be still, Nance!"
Dennis ordered. They dropped to the floor for a moment, but were soon moving about again. Not even the bones kept them quiet for more than a short time. Lady Constance talked pleasantly with her ladies, but Sir Peter seemed to be always listening. While they were still at table, there was a sudden commotion. Shouts and cries from the inner ward came up through the windows, and a sound of running feet pounding along the passage. Sir Peter started from his chair. Adam the yeoman came bursting into the hall, so hurried with ill news that he scarcely stopped to bob his head before speaking.
"Your lordship!" he began, out of breath. "We are attacked. The Welsh are hammering at the town gate. They have slain the watch by creeping close to the wall in the fog. They waited for him to turn, then put an arrow in his back."
"'Tis come, then," said Sir Peter, reaching for the great sword which hung on the wall. "What strength are they? Is it known?"
"It is hard to say," said Adam. "They make a great noise about the walls, but naught can be seen for the fog. They have built fires under the south gate, and flambeaux glow on all sides, so I fear we are surrounded."
"Gather every man, not armed, into the inner bailey, where they will be provided with longbows and arrows," directed Sir Peter. To Lady Constance he said, "You, my dear wife, gather all the women and children into the keep. Have them bring clothing and pallets. There, at least, we have water in the well, and 'tis a strong fortress."
"Yes, my husband," Lady Constance said obediently, rising and gathering the children to her, while her ladies hastily collected embroidery frames, cloaks and fripperies.
The two pages, Dennis and Lionel, carried the food from the table, then took the table boards from the trestles and transferred everything to the hall of the keep. The keep was close to the gatehouse between the inner and outer ward, so there was great excitement in the courtyard.
"What can I do?" asked Robin.
"Will you care for the little boys?" asked Lady Constance. "Little Alison shall come with us."
"Yes,"
promised Robin.
"Each can hold to my jerkin, so we shall keep together among the yeomen."
When the boys had been safely delivered to the keep, Robin remembered the little harp which lay unfinished in the workshop under the south wall. He must get it and keep it safe too. Before morning, the walls of the town had been breached, and before the day was out, the town was taken. When the portcullis of the outer bailey of the castle was raised to admit the yeomen, the townspeople swarmed in. Allan at gate directed the dropping of the heavy iron gate, and it came down so quickly that the last man to enter narrowly missed having his head chopped off. The fog held for days. The Welsh could not get beyond the outer wall of the castle, and the English inside could not tell what strength the enemy possessed. They might be encamped on the surrounding hills, or they might be only a small company. Several of the guards on the wall had been injured, and sometimes the yeoman could tell that an arrow had struck home in the enemy's camp. Most of the time there was only watchful waiting on both sides. The Welsh had a machine for catapulting stones, most of which thudded harmlessly into the courtyard. Sometimes one struck the inner wall, but most of them fell short, dropping into the moat. Inside the keep, women occupied themselves with spinning, weaving and embroidery. It helped the time to pass more quickly. The children played with toy soldiers and blocks, with hobby horses and with dolls. Sometimes Robin told them tales or sang songs, but he spent most of the time in the chamber where he slept, working on the Saxon harp. William Wise had set up a workbench for him and had finished the tool of hardened iron. There was a small lathe for turning the keys and a vise, all arranged so that Robin could sit on a stool to reach them.
The tool for making the holes was sharp, so that part was not difficult. Just as John Go in the Wind had said, it was harder to turn the keys on the lathe so they would fit exactly. They were either too large and would not go in, or, when they had been turned smaller, they were too small and would not hold the strings in tune. But Robin was learning patience. He had found out that the harder it was to do something, the more comfortable he felt after he had done it. Sir Peter had stood all of one night on the bastion, directing and encouraging the men. They had managed to drive off a raiding party that was trying to scale the wall. Now he was in bed with a chill, and Lady Constance waited upon him. The food in the larder dwindled, and there were many people to be fed. Besides the garrison and the household, there were the yeomen from the town, and those who had sought refuge when the portcullis was raised. Usually there was a good supply of salt fish kept in barrels, but fish had not been plentiful the past summer, so now the supply was meagre. There was mutton, to be sure, but it was all on four legs and scattered over the downs beyond the castle and town. The winter kill had not taken place because they waited for freezing weather. There was flour to last for a short time, but the yearly portion from the peasants' holdings was to have been brought to the castle the following week. Besides, there had been a small crop of grain because of the summer's drought. Then the water began to fail. As Robin came into the hall at supper time, he passed the table where the retainers sat. Dennis leaned to whisper in the ear of Adam the yeoman.
"There is scarce a foot of water in the well," he whispered. "Just now, as I drew it to fill this ewer, the cook told me."
"How came this?" asked Adam. "'Tis known that this is a good well. Tell not her ladyship, and send the word around that the water must be used sparingly, or 'twill not last the week out, even for drinking."
He thought a moment, then said,
"Someone must go for help, or we shall be forced to surrender the castle. It might be that Sir Hugh Fitzhugh would come to our aid, for he, too, is in danger from the Welsh if they break our defence. But whom shall we spare? All are needed at their posts."
"Let me go," said Robin. "I can go out the small door at the north whilst it is early morning. No one will suspect me. They think me a poor shepherd. I shall borrow a smock from William the Farrier's son, and if I am seen, I shall appear stupid. We shall keep it secret, for if Sir Peter were to find out my plan, he would forbid me to go, not knowing how strong I am."
"But thou art only a lad," Adam objected, "and art cumbered with crutches as well. And how wilt thou cross the river? The bridge is well guarded at both ends."
"I shall go well, never fear,"
Robin assured them confidently. "I have it all in my head how it shall be done. I shall find John Go in the Wind at his mother's cottage in Tripheath village. John shall set forth from there for Sir Hugh and his men. Now, let us plan. First, I want you, Dennis, to bring me the smock and some rags to wrap about my legs. Then, see you, find me a hood that is worn and faded. Besides, I shall need long leather thongs to tie the crutches to my back, for I shall swim the river."
"Fear you not the soldiery?" queried Dennis anxiously. "Will you not fall down the steep bank? 'Tis a far distance to the bottom of the ravine, and—"
He stopped suddenly, because one of the maids appeared.
"See to it," said Robin with a quick nod.
That evening there was no gathering about the fire. Everyone was restless. The hounds were still uneasy, walking about, cocking their ears at the least sound. Lady Constance took one of her women to examine the stores. Robin was afraid she would discover how low the water was in the well. Instead, she seemed confident that there was sufficient.
"How fortunate we are that there is plenty of water," she said. "Sir Peter says that our well has never failed."
Dennis looked at Robin, knowing that he shared the secret. Dennis, knowing Robin's plan, was in a fidget to be through with his duties and find William the Farrier's son and borrow his clothes. He would probably be with his father at the forge, repairing pikes and lances and heating oil for pouring onto the enemy in case they should pierce the outer castle wall. Robin put on his warmest under-tunic and carefully put away the little harp and all the parts and tools so that they would be safe. He looked at it regretfully, hating to leave it. Then, when all was ready except changing his clothes, he sought out Brother Luke, for he knew that the friar would give him help and encouragement. Dressed in the patched and ragged smock, his legs wound about with bits of rag to hold the ill-fitting hosen, Robin tried to sleep away the early part of the night, but excitement kept him wakeful. Even when he dozed, he was aware of what he was about to do. He counted over all the things he must remember. He must go softly with the crutches. He must remember the leather thongs. As Brother Luke had told him, he mustn't forget oil for the rusty lock of the door in the wall. He must keep Dath quiet. Just before dawn, Brother Luke touched him.
"Come, my son," he whispered. "We shall say the office before it is time to set forth on thy mission."
When the prayers were finished, Robin pulled on the faded hood, tucked the leather thong inside it, and followed the friar. Dath rose from sleep to follow after, but Robin touched his head and whispered a command for him to stop.
"Dath, stay you here," he said,
wishing very much that the dog could go with him. They went down a half flight of steps and across the hall of the keep to the winding stair, making their way quietly among the sleeping servants. They went very slowly, for Robin's crutches tapped an alarm when he made haste, and the least misstep would have sent him clattering down. There was still fog when they came into the open, but it had begun to drift, and there was a grey dawn just beginning to break.
"Who goes there?"
demanded the sentry at the door. But seeing Robin and the friar, he allowed them to pass, thinking they were bent on some holy errand. Robin shuddered.
"Art fearful, my son?" asked the friar.
"Not truly," answered Robin, "though 'tis weird in the fog."
"Aye, 'tis an eerie feeling to be out in the cheerless dawn, not knowing at what moment an enemy may appear out of the fog,"
agreed Brother Luke. And at that moment a face did appear, but it was only one of the guards, who thought the two were on their way to the chapel. They reached the sallyport in the north wall without meeting anyone else. Brother Luke dripped oil into the lock before trying to open the door. Robin listened.
"Hark," he whispered. "I hear the Welsh sentry outside. We can count the paces and tell how far away he is. 1, 2, 3, 4.
They counted 40 paces.
"Now."
Slowly the door opened and Robin slipped outside.
"Benedicite,"
whispered the friar in blessing, and closed the door. Quickly Robin moved away from the door and the wall. In a moment he was at the edge of the deep ravine. He could hear the river far below, but could not see it for the fog. Now began the dangerous descent. Carefully Robin tested each clod of earth, each bit of stone, before trusting his weight to the crutches, praying the while that the fog would hold. Sometimes he slid on his haunches, sometimes seedling trees held him till he was able to find sure footing.
"If I should start a stone rolling," he thought, "the whole Welsh army will be upon my neck."
It seemed hours to Robin that he was sliding, groping, laboring down the treacherous cliff. But it was only a few moments, for the light of morning had scarcely changed when he reached the bottom and found himself at the edge of the river. He stopped only long enough to fasten the crutches onto his back with the leathern thong, and to wind his hood into a kind of hat that perched on top of his head. Then he plunged into the icy water, not allowing himself to consider whether he had the courage to do it. When first the water closed over him, Robin thought he could not bear it. The crutches were awkward. His chest felt tightly squeezed, and as if sharp knives pierced him. He seemed unable to breathe, and his head felt ready to burst. But he struck out fiercely, and, after a few strokes, began to breathe more easily. Warmth crept through his body, and a feeling of power, as if nothing could be too difficult for him. He swam strongly across the swift current toward the path he had seen from the top of the tower. What if the enemy should be camped on the other side? Suppose they wouldn't believe he was the poor shepherd he pretended to be? Suppose he found it impossible to get up the bank on the other side?
"Anyone could not do it," he said to himself stubbornly, and thrashed his arms more fiercely.
At last he felt the stones of shallower water under his feet. The bank appeared mistily green, and he was able to hold himself steady with one hand while he untied the crutches and set them under his armpits. The bank was not very steep after all, and in a moment he was at the top, ready to go on. His teeth chattered in the rising wind. His feet felt as if they had been frozen. His hands were so numb with cold he could hardly hold the crutches to steady them as he walked. He paused long enough to let down the hood into its proper shape. The warm wool felt good, although it was wet along the edges. Then he looked about for signs of the path. It shone so clearly from the top of the tower. He moved along the bank a few paces where generations of peasants had worn a highway, and soon came to the path. The fog was lifting somewhat with the wind, and Robin, looking back once, caught sight of the castle he had left behind. He even caught a glimpse of the sentry along the narrow ridge just where he had so lately escaped by the door in the wall. After passing through a patch of brush and willows, Robin came out into a field. He still could not see very far ahead, but the path was straight before him, so he began to swing along as fast as he could, his crutches making great sweeping circles, his feet covering the ground in tremendous strides. There seemed to be no one about, so he made haste without regard to noise, and gradually the numbness in his hands and feet began to ease. Across the field he went, swing, step, swing, step, swing, step. The fog wavered and lifted, swirled about in sudden drafts, floated across the path in thin layers, showed a patch of blue sky for an instant and glimpses of trees ahead. Suddenly, a voice rang out.
"Who goes there?"
Robin stopped.
"'Tis but I, Robin,"
he answered in a meek voice, and the chill that ran down his spine was not all from the dampness of his clothing.
"Robin who?"
the voice went on.
"Robin, Crookshank, some call me,"
answered Robin. The fog parted, showing the fierce and scowling head of a man. The guard drew near where he could see the boy.
"Aha," he said. "Art thou but a shepherd boy, then?"
he asked, seeing Robin's poor clothes.
"And hast fallen into the river? Come then, lad, and warm thyself by the fire. Be not frighted, we'll not hurt thee."
He took Robin's arm and tried to draw him toward the camp, which now Robin could see just at the side of the field, for now the fog was fast disappearing. But Robin held back and shook his head, trying to think what he must say and how he must speak.
"Nay,"
he began, trying to appear stupid.
"'Tis na far to the cottage."
He edged away, bobbing his thanks, and went on as fast as he dared up the other side of the field and through the hedgerow. He did not stop until he was well beyond earshot of the men in the camp, then stood only for a moment to draw long, steadying breaths. He chuckled at the way he had fooled the Welshmen. From that point on, the path led through a wood and downward toward the valley of a stream which joined the one surrounding the castle. There were no cottages near at hand, but across the stream and beyond a low-lying field and a rising slope, Robin could see the wood that extended to the edge of the village where the church tower stood. The sky now was filled with fast-flying clouds and the fog was gone. The stream was shallow enough for Robin to go across on foot, and the little wetting he got was nothing after swimming the river. The wood behind him hid Robin from the camp in the field, for which he was thankful, because the rising ground slowed his going, and he felt as if he were a fair target for arrows. It seemed as if he would never come to the top of the field, and the hedgerows separating it from the forest beyond. When he reached the shelter of the great trees, Robin sank down into a bed of bracken to rest. He was very tired. When breathing was easier and the pain of effort but a dull ache, Robin rose to go on. How much farther had he to go? Would John be there when he arrived? Would he be able to get help in time? Even through the forest, the path was well marked, because it was one that had been used for centuries. The peasants went over it to and from the villages to gather wood or to pasture the sheep. In about an hour, the forest began to thin, and Robin could see the blue smoke coming from the cottar's chimney pots. Which cottage belonged to John's mother? Robin remembered that John had said it was on the heath and near the church. He could see such a cottage from where he stood, so he made his way toward it, hopefully. It was so exciting to be within sight of help that Robin forgot that he was tired and hungry. He forgot that he was still cold from his dousing in the river and the fright he'd had. He began to cut across the heath toward the cottage, but had not gone far when John himself came out of the door. Robin stopped.
"John!"
he called at the top of his voice.
"John! Oh, John, go in the wind!"
John heard him and looked his way, then came running.
"Master Robin!" he exclaimed. "What's amiss? How came thou here?"
Without waiting for an answer, he grasped Robin's crutches and swept him up into his arms because he could see that Robin had come as far as he was able. It had been Robin's plan to issue orders as his father might have done, to have been lordly and commanding. But it was such a relief to be cared for and to have the weight of his body taken from his aching armpits that he allowed John to carry him and said not a word until he was laid upon the straw pallet. An old woman stood by the fire, stirring something in a pot. She looked at Robin but didn't speak. A cat mewed and coaxed her, rubbing against her skirts.
"The castle is in danger," said Robin at once. "The Welsh have taken the town and are at the gates of the Outer Bailey. The food is giving out. The water low in the well. You must get help. You must get it soon." "But how came thou here?" said John, amazed. "How didst escape the sentry?"
John was already putting on his hood and fastening his leather jerkin. He went on without waiting.
"Knowst what force the Welsh have?" "No," said Robin. "The fog has kept us from seeing, but whenever we try to make a sally into the town, we were forced back. I shall be gone straight away. Stay thou here for safety and to rest."
John Go in the Wind was well named, for go he did, closing the door behind him almost before he had finished speaking. Robin sighed. It was good to be able to rest.
"Come now," said the woman, as she took off Robin's clothes to dry them. "Thou'lt be famished with hunger. I'll bake thee a bannock."
As tired as he was, Robin grinned. She went to the cupboard and took out a flat cake, which she put on a hot stone to bake. Robin slept after the woman fed him, and didn't wake until the sun was low in the west. The sound of the door opening was what really woke him. It was John. Robin was up on his elbow in a second.
"Did you not go then?" he asked in bewilderment.
Then he realized he had slept, and that it was late in the day.
"Did you find help then?"
"Yes, already they are well on their way from my Lord Hugh Fitzhugh's castle," said John. "A large force of foot soldiers and a company of lancers go by the Drover's Road, one company by the way through wood and field, and another going around to attack from the other side of the town by way of Leatham Bridge. It hath been agreed that we shall give the signal from the bell tower of the church. There are no better bowmen in England. The siege will be lifted, thou'lt see."
"I want to see it," declared Robin. "I want to see it all."
"See it thou shalt," promised John. "Now, mither, serve forth yon porridge, for I have not broken my fast this day."
The mother bustled about, putting the porridge into a bowl for all to dip into and drawing a bench up to the table. John laid out the little harp, put bread into his pouch, and stuck a knife in his belt.
"I am no warrior," he said to Robin. "I am but a messenger and minstrel. But who knows? I might find myself close to the enemy. Closer than I would like," he added with a shrug.
The meal was soon over, and they made ready to start.
"Think you I can go so far again this day?" asked Robin, anxiously.
"Thou hast no need to think of that," John assured him. "I can carry thee right well, as the good friar did. The harp and the crutches we shall strap on, so they will not cumber us."
He fastened the crutches to his side, and the harp around Robin's neck, so it hung down his back.
"Soon thou'lt be carrying thine own harp, God willing." "Fare thee well, old mother," said John, embracing her. "Up now, young master," he said to Robin, and with that they left the cottage and went on their way.
"How shall we go?"
asked Robin, as John strode down the path on the way out of the village.
"Shall we go by the way I came here, or by way of Leatham Bridge?"
"Neither," answered John Go in the Wind. "I know still another way. I know a path leading through the forest to the southeast. It goes past the priory where we shall ford the river. We can come at the town easily from there. Then we can wait for nightfall, and indeed it will be nightfall ere we arrive, but there will be a moon. We shall creep along the river under cover of the reeds and willows, and enter the town through the shoemaker's house, which is on the wall. He is known to me, and we have a signal between us. He knoweth the sound of my harp, and the certain tune I play will tell him we have need of him. From there it is quite simple to get into the graveyard of the church, thence into the church itself, and into the tower. There we shall see all, and hear all, if we are not deafened by the bells."
"What an adventure to tell my father," cried Robin.
Although he carried Robin, John trotted along at a good speed, for he knew every curve in the path. It was only a short way to the ford of the river, near the priory, and from there across fields covered with grazing sheep to the forest. There they rested. When they reached the top of the hill beyond, John pointed out the drover's road far below. There, glints of light on lance and pennant, helmet and moving figures, showed Robin the fast-moving company of soldiers. Because it was nearly dusk and supper-time, blue smoke rose from every chimney-pot in the village they had left, and in the low places mist began to rise. "We must make haste," said John, lifting Robin again to his back, "or we shall be too late." When they had to cross open country again, John kept to the hedgerows so they would not be seen, and as they came nearer to Lindsay, he kept well away from every barn and outbuilding.
"For aught we know, the Welsh may be encamped out here on this side of the castle, as well as on the other," he explained. "They might question even a minstrel such as I. 'Tis safer for our skins to go softly."
By the time they reached the place where the drover's road led, John halted before crossing the road to observe the sentry. They waited for the sound of his footsteps to die away around the town. The moon was high, and by keeping well in the shadow of a tree, they were able to cross the road without being seen.
"Ah," said John with a sigh of relief, "so far we have come safely. Soon Sir Hugh's men will encircle the town. By then we shall be in the church tower to give the signal for attack." "We have not seen the enemy on this side of the town," whispered Robin, hopefully.
"No," agreed John, "because they have taken the town and will be inside the walls. There is more need of outposts to the south and west, where the two bridges are, and where the roads leading from them are well travelled. The Welsh will reason that there is little likelihood of danger from this road, because it is well known that Sir Peter and his cousin Sir Hugh are not on friendly terms. Sir Peter is for the king and for England. Sir Hugh is not. But they are of one family, and were once like brothers. I had little difficulty in persuading him, Sir Hugh."
"Perhaps they will be friends from now on," said Robin. "Perhaps Sir Hugh will be one for the king."
"It may be," John nodded. "Most of the lords in this part of the country are for keeping their lands to themselves. But times are changing, and we have a good king."
"Hark," whispered Robin again. "All is still. The sentry is at the far end of his walk. Shall we go then?"
"Aye, 'tis time," said John. "Hast the little harp safe?"
"'Tis safe," said Robin, grasping John about the neck and getting himself settled on his back.
They crept forward again, shielded by the darkness, and made their way along a narrow path that followed the wall until the rising ground told John they were near to the shoemaker's cottage. There again they halted to make sure no sentry was about. John, letting Robin slip to the ground, fitted the crutches under his arms and took the harp from about his neck. The tune he played was mournful and slow, but it must have reached the ears of the shoemaker. John was just beginning to play it for the third time when there was an answer to it in the form of a bagpipe jig. Robin could see John bobbing his head up and down happily because his playing had brought forth the right response. There followed another period of waiting while the sentry passed again on the wall. They scarcely breathed until he had turned again and was going the other way. By counting his steps, they knew when he was far enough away for them to act. Then, without warning, a sort of chair was let down from a window high in the wall. John fastened Robin into it and gave the rope a jerk. Robin was hauled aloft so quickly that he had no time to think what he should do or what he should say. He found himself being lifted inside the upper room of a small house and the window drawn to. He faced a little man who cautioned him to silence while again they waited for the sentry to come and to go. There was no light in the room except the moonlight that came in through the window.
"This is really exciting," thought Robin.
He wished that John had been able to come into the house with him. He heard the tramp, tramp of the sentry and the thudding of the pike staff as it struck the stone when the sentry turned at the wall of the house. The sound lessened and once more the rope was lowered. This time it was for John. Robin could see the iron wheel under the window, which turned like a windlass to let out the rope. In a moment John stood in the room with him. The rope and iron wheel were stored in an innocent-looking chest. The shoemaker quickly lifted the wheel out of the strong wooden block, which held it covered with a flat board and cloth. The shoemaker motioned for Robin and John to follow him, down the steep stair leading to the house below. They did not linger in the house, but with a few words to the shoemaker, left by way of the garden. There was a door in the wall leading into the graveyard of the church, where John and Robin slipped quietly from one great tombstone to another. They entered the church by the sanctuary door, startling the sacristan, who slept and ate in a small room off the entrance porch.
"Who art thou?" he called, hearing the creak of the door. "Art friend or foe?"
"Hist!" warned John, stepping quickly toward the light of the lantern held by the sacristan.
"We are friends. I am John Gawain the Wind, minstrel. This lad is young Master Robin, friend and ward of Sir Peter. He hath this day saved us all."
The sacristan held the lantern up where he could see John's face.
"Now I mind thee," he said, nodding his head. "I knew thy father."
John told the sacristan how Robin had come to warn him and to get help, and described the plan he had made with Sir Hugh to sound the bells giving the signal for attack.
"Come with me, then," said the sacristan, leading the way.
They went down the long, dark aisle of the church to the door of the tower.
"Give me thy crutches here, young master," said John. "Canst thou climb the ladder, or wilt go pick a back? 'Tis a great height, but there are resting places."
"I can do it," said Robin shortly. Had he not climbed to the towers and turrets of the castle many times? They had just reached the belfry when it was time for curfew to ring. The bells began an ear-splitting clamour.
"Down flat and cover thy ears, quick," shouted John.
They flattened themselves on the platform and endured the deafening sound.
"We shall go to the top first," said John, "for it is yet too soon to give the signal, and from there we shall see somewhat."
From the belfry to the top of the tower, it was another 30 feet of climbing. When they reached the top, Robin fell into a heap on the platform, with every bit of strength gone from his legs and arms. It slowly returned. In a little while he was able to rise and stand beside John, looking out over the town.
"We agreed that I should wait an hour after curfew, when the moon will be nearly overhead," said John. "That allows time for all companies to be in place, and with the sounding of the bell, to move in about the town and castle wall at once."
"How can you tell when it has been an hour?" asked Robin.
"By the feel of it," said John. "Besides, I shall play Love a Garland Is and Lament of a Lass. That will be half of the hour."
He unslung the harp from Robin's back and began the music. While they waited for the rest of the hour to pass, John pointed out the familiar turrets of the castle, the north tower where they had stood that day, and the tower of the keep where the household waited for deliverance. He strummed on the harp between times. They tried to see into the hills about the town, but saw only the quiet countryside bathed in moonlight. In the town, supper fires sent up blue smoke, and here and there was the red glare of torchlight and campfire. Glints of moonlight on helmet or shield shone from the walls where sentries walked, but very little sound could be heard at that height. The hour was up.
"Now," said John, "it is time for the alarm. Stay thou here, and I shall return. Cover thy ears well, but watch to see what happens."
He was gone through the hatch into the darkness below. Robin waited, his skin prickling with excitement. Would the signal be at the right time? Would the arrows find their mark and lift the siege?
The great bell rang, sending waves of sound that went out over the hills and came echoing back into the stone of the bell tower, which trembled with the vibration.
At first Robin could see nothing different from what he had seen before.
Then it was as if a part of the landscape itself moved off there toward the south, just below the edge of the town. Gathering from the slopes were tiny moving figures, now in the open, now lost in shadow.
Robin searched for another sign, this time in the direction of Leatham Bridge. The sign was there where he could see more clearly. John came up, breathing hard.
"What's to be seen?" he asked. "Are they moving? Hast seen any arrows fly?"
He looked to the Leatham Bridge. Then it came. A hail of arrows that were like dark rain sped from oncoming yeomen, dropping the sentries on the bridge and picking off men of the guard manning the wall of the town. From where they stood, Robin could see it all as plainly as if it had been a toy village set in a toy landscape, and the soldiers, toy soldiers. He saw pikemen strike down sentries of the enemy at the town gate and take prisoner the Welsh guards.
He saw the company of Sir Hugh's men enter and take the town. It had been a complete surprise. When John Go-in-the-Wind saw what was happening and realized that the plan had been successful, he tossed his hat into the air and clasped Robin in his arms. "We've won!" he shouted. "The Welsh are routed! Lindsay is saved once more!" Then, setting Robin on his feet again, he said, "Stay thou here, and watch how the Welsh are marched out of the town whilst I go below. Thou'lt hear such a peal of bells as shall nigh wake the dead lying below." Down he went again through the hatch to the belfry. With the pealing of the bells, flares went up from castle and town. Windows and doors opened. The peal of bells stopped. John came back, and together they watched the lifting of the siege. They could see people running about through the streets, embracing one another, tossing caps and hats into the air, and in other ways showing their joy at being freed of the Welsh invaders. In a short while they saw the enemy marched out of town. Tears streamed down Robin's cheeks. "I must not cry," he thought, wiping them away, "not even for joy." "No," said John, lifting Robin aloft. "Thou'lt be carried on my shoulder, so, for thou art the hero of this victory." And together they went down the long stretches of ladder and stair to the ground. "Make haste," said Robin. "Let us go to the keep at once, so Sir Peter and Lady Constance shall know that I am safe and well. Brother Luke will be sure of it, for his prayers have followed me this day, that I know." All the way through the town square, John made his way with Robin on his shoulder, high above the villagers, dancing in the dawn of returning day. They were greeted with cheers at the castle gate, and followed across the courtyard to the inner gate and to the keep by the cheering crowd. Alan at gate saw them from the gatehouse. The drawbridge was lowered and the portcullis raised, and just inside the whole company of the household stood to receive them. Sir Peter was in the centre with his sons and the two pages. Near him was Lady Constance with her women and little Alison. Dath whimpered joyfully beside Brother Luke. Sir Peter held out his arms and helped Robin to the ground, placing the crutches to support him. Then, placing his hand upon Robin's head, he spoke solemnly. "Now, before God and this company," he said, "I do hail thee, conqueror and true son of thy noble father." Lady Constance embraced Robin, and the women made much of him. Dath was too well-bred a dog to push himself forward, but his eager prancing and wriggling finally brought him to Robin's side, where he thrust his long, cold nose into Robin's hands. John Go-in-the-Wind was called forward. He was given a holding of land for his own and a portion of sheep. With it went certain rights for hunting and fishing to be his and his heirs for ever. Brother Luke gave Robin his blessing, and went with him to his chamber. "It seems long since I left here," said Robin, looking around as if he expected things to be changed. But there was the cross over his bed, and there, on the workbench, the little harp just as he had left it, waiting for the strings to be fastened to the keys. "Much hath happened in this one day," said Brother Luke. "I should like to hear how thy journey went. By thy look thou hast fared well, except for needing a good wash and a sleep. Off with thy borrowed clothes, and once more I shall care for thee." Sleep overtook Robin even before Brother Luke had finished. The days grew short and very cold. Everyone went about with a red nose and a cloud of frozen breath. Robin was glad of the woolen gloves made for him by Lady Constance. They were snug and warm and decorated with needlework on the back. The river ran more slowly now, and ice began to form along the edges. Robin stopped swimming and took his exercise in other ways. He spent a great deal of time with Adam Bowyer shooting at a mark, and was already at work again in the carpentry shop, making a viol such as Piers Nightingale used. The harp was finished. Robin had learned how to tune it by tightening the strings, and could play it a little. Brother Luke was teaching him to sing a carol, because it was near to the feast of Christmas. There would be singing and caroling in the hall, and Robin remembered his father's letter, and hoped that Christmas would bring his father and mother to the castle. One day before the feast of Thomas the Apostle, and after the feast of St. Lucy, the 13th of December, Robin was with Sir Peter in the armory. The coats of mail, the helmets, the lances, pikes, bows, and arrows were being put in order, and the great two-handed sword hung on the wall. "See you here," said Sir Peter.
This is where the blow struck my helmet. There is a dent as large as a basin.
He rubbed his head where the helmet had been thrust in. Robin ran his fingers around the ugly cavity, imagining how it would feel to be struck with a mace. He was thinking of his father, and wondering whether he, too, had been wounded.
"Will the Scottish wars have ended, think you?" he asked.
"I have had no word directly," answered Sir Peter. "There have been rumours about that troops of returning soldiers have been seen. Some were going southward along the high road. John Go in the Wind might tell us if he were here, but he has not been nigh the castle for weeks. I dare say he is busy building shelter for his new flocks and gathering wood for the winter, that his old mother may be warm."
Robin said no more, but after that he went often to the top of the keep to scan the countryside for signs of horsemen. Sometimes he could see nothing for fog or rain. Sometimes the air was crisp and clear, and he could see far beyond the hills. Once a cloud of dust on the road moving toward the town kept him excited for an hour, but it proved to be only a flock of sheep being driven to market. Once a company of lancers appeared, but they turned southward. On the afternoon of the eve of Christmas, Robin was at his post on top of the keep with Adam Bowyer, who was on watch. It began to snow. Robin watched while the silent whiteness covered the hills and the roofs of the town. Far, far below, he could see a hawking party. He could see the pages coming from the forest, dragging the yule log and branches of holly to decorate the hall. Suddenly, Adam Bowyer cried, "Look! Look yonder!" He pointed east, where the road led into the high road and to the town gate. Robin left the north side of the tower and joined Adam, looking toward where he pointed. The snow dimmed what he saw, but it was clear enough. A company of knights and men-at-arms rode toward the castle. At the head rode the king, for only he wore the royal colours and the royal quarterings of the banners. At his side rode one who sat his horse as only Robin's father did. In the midst of the great company were ladies, pikemen, men-at-arms, and yeomen. That must be the queen. Was it the Lady Maud there, beside her in the centre? It must be. Robin burst into a cheer.
"It is true," he shouted. "It is true. The Scottish wars are over, and my father is alive."
He must say nothing about his mother, for fear Adam would think him babyish. He dashed down the winding stair as fast as he dared, crossed the inner ward to the hall, thump, slip, thump, slip, and then to the solar to find Sir Peter. Thump, slip, thump, slip, thump, slip, thump, slip. Sir Peter roared with laughter at Robin's attempt to tell him about the approaching company, for he knew from the moment he had seen Robin's shining face the good news.
"Shall I go to the gate to be there when they enter, think you?" asked Robin anxiously.
"Do what seems best, my boy," said Sir Peter. "Go stand beside Alan at gate, or stay you here by my side. I know what a fever of excitement is in thy bones, but do what you most want to do."
Robin felt as if he must run to meet the company, must see his father, and feel the comfort of his mother's arms about him. Yet he felt timid about facing either of them. They would find him so changed.
"If I stand beside you, my lord, they will surely know it is I. If they see me in the courtyard, they may think I am but one of the stable boys. I shall stay here."
"Come, lad," said Sir Peter. "Let us go to the window of the tower. There we can see the company cross the drawbridge, and before they have dismounted, we can be back ready to welcome them in the hall at the head of the stair."
Before leaving the hall, Sir Peter called Dennis the page and sent word to Lady Constance to be ready to greet the noble visitors. He and Robin went quickly up the winding stair to the turret overlooking the drawbridge. They reached it in time to hear the pounding of the hooves on the timbers of the bridge and to see the waving banners. The handsome, erect figure of Sir John de Burford was fitting company for the noble-looking king. And there, now just passing into the courtyard, was Robin's lovely mother, the veil of her coif floating and mingling with that of the queen whom she attended. There was no time for greeting or waving. The tumult of horse and weapon made too much noise for voices to have been heard. Sir Peter grasped Robin and swung him across his back. They went swiftly back the way they had come and were standing in welcome at the head of the great staircase as the company entered. Who spoke first, or what was first said, it would be hard to tell. Robin found himself bowing to kiss his mother's hand, then felt her soft arms about him.
"Robin, my Robin,"
she whispered, and for a moment said no more, but only held him close as if she could not let him go. The crutches fell to the stone floor with a great clatter. Robin's father bent to pick them up, laughing to keep from showing how deeply he was moved by the sight of them.
"He is my son, too," he said, gently tugging at the mother's close-enfolding arms and holding Robin at arm's length to look into his face. "You are grown," he said. "Your eyes no longer outrace your chin as do a child's. You've now the look of a youth."
Sir John embraced his son warmly. Nothing was said of crutches, or of misshapen legs, or of ill fortune, or of good. Sir Peter spoke. "Shall we not allow our guests to retire?"
"Yes," agreed the king. "Later we shall hear news of the war's ending and how all have fared this long year. Let us go our several ways and meet again in the hall, for we are spent with weariness and soiled with travel."
With another touch of his mother's hand, Robin left the company and went to find Brother Luke and to make himself ready for the audience. There never was such merrymaking as took place in the hall that Christmas Eve. Such ballads sung, such tales told. Branches of holly and spruce decked the hall and filled the air with fragrance. The yule log burned on the hearth and flaming torches filled the sconces. The king and queen sat enthroned in the great chairs on the dais. A tapestry was draped on the screen behind them and rich eastern carpets beneath. Sir Peter and Lady Constance sat at one side of the king and queen, and Sir John and Lady Maud at the other. Robin entered the hall with Brother Luke as he had been commanded, and at a signal came forward to stand before the dais. He wore a black velvet doublet and carried the Saxon harp on his back. As usual, Dath followed at his heels. Robin felt as though the hall were as long as London Bridge, for when he entered all was quiet, and his crutches seemed to make a great sound on the stone floor. Servants and courtiers bowed as he passed. What was going to happen? What had the king to say to him? Would his parents leave him and go back to London? At last he reached the dais. The king rose and stood over Robin, lifting from his own shoulders a chain of gold set with medallions of fine workmanship. Then he spoke. "Can you kneel, my son?" he asked.
"I can for a little time, sire," answered Robin. "Long enough to say Our Father."
He dropped to the cushion, supporting himself with one crutch. The friar took the other. "Robin, son of Sir John de Burford," the king said solemnly, "it hath been told to us what service you have done for the lord of this castle and me, king of the whole realm of England and France. You are a true son of a noble father. Though but a youth, you have shown courage a man might be proud to call his own." The king spread out the jeweled collar and dropped it onto Robin's shoulders, saying, "This shall be a token of our high regard, and with it go our grateful thanks." "Rise, young Robin," he commanded, and himself raised Robin to his feet. Robin was filled with gratitude to the king, because now his father could be proud of him. He could not speak for a moment, and indeed knew of nothing to say. But cheers and hand-clapping began to make such a noise and clatter that no speech could have been heard. When the noise had quieted a little, Robin was quieter too. He remembered the carol he had been learning for this very night, and words came to him. "Sire," Robin began, "I do thank you for this great honour, and I beg you to accept my song of Christmas." He brought forward the little harp he had grown to love and sang this carol. "Come to Bethlehem and see him whose birth the angels sing. Come, adore, on bended knee, Christ the Lord, the newborn King. Gloria in excelsis Deo, Gloria in excelsis Deo." When the song was ended, once more the hall rang with shouts and cheers.
"Sir Robin! Sir Robin!"
Robin found himself standing between his mother and his father. "Sir Robin,
was it he?"
"Sir," he addressed his father, "mind you not that I must go thus, bent over, and with these crutches to help me walk?" For he must know the worst at once. Gravely, Sir John answered,
"The courage you have shown, the craftsmanship proven by the harp,
and the spirit in your singing all make so bright a light that I cannot see whether or no your legs are misshapen.
As for me, said Lady Maud, slipping her arm about Robin, what a comfort it will be to know that wars will never claim you, and you can come home, for there is now no need for you to stay here at Lindsay, nor is there further need for me to be with the Queen. She is now in good health. When the Feast of Christmas is over, we shall all go home to London. Brother Luke shall come with us to be your tutor, if he will.
When the midnight office was said in the church, the whole household trooped back to the hall, where tables were spread for the feast. Platters were heaped with food and carried in by pages and esquires. A giant boar's head came first in order, then pasties and whole suckling pigs, pigeons and geese roasted with feathers on. The meats were followed by flaming puddings and bowls of wassail, chestnuts and apples. Dath and the other hounds feasted too, for all the scraps were thrown into the rushes on the floor. It was nearly dawn when Robin felt himself lifted onto Brother Luke's back, for he had fallen asleep.
"Where am I?" he asked in bewilderment. "What has happened?"
"Thou art here, Sir Robin," said the friar, "safe with all thy loved ones. 'Tis the Feast of Christmas, and thou hast found the door in thy wall."
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Door in the Wall by Marguerite D'Angeli. This program was produced and directed by Steve Blaine. Original music by Richard DeRosa. Production copyright 1998. Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing, all rights reserved. The book, The Door in the Wall, is available wherever Dell Yearling books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.